This oral history project is part of the 2023 Vintage Festival. This project was made possible thanks to the sponsorship of the Peter Lehman Foundation and Barossa Village, the creative energies and skills of the Emu Tree, Daisy Love George, and the staff at Barossa Village. This project was designed to create a lasting memory of the people who contributed so much to our community. I'm sitting here with Milton Materny from Greenock. Milton, thank you for being a part of this program, the Barossa Village Oral History Project. Could I ask you please just to state your full name and your date of birth? Thank you.
Milton Materny. I was born 19 of October 1934.
Thank you. Can you tell me a little bit about your parents, please?
Dad was born in the family home where I grew up. He went to Greenock School. Well, first he went to Nain School, and then the latter part of his schooling he went to Greenock School. But for a period of time, because Nain was only German, then they'd have German in Nain, and then sometimes in the afternoon have English lessons in Greenock. And he finished his schooling in Greenock, and he never went to high school. He only just went to school. And when he finished school, he stayed home, worked with his dad, who had a family farm.
What was your father's name, Milton?
Erhard, E-R-H-A-R-D-T. Mum was born out in Neukirch, or out Ebenezer, on the old Kleinig farm.
And what was your mother's name?
Laura. L-A-U-R-A, Kleinig, K-L-E-I-N-I-G.
Your ancestors came out of Prussia.
At Auschwitz, that's where we came from. The great-grandfather and grandmother, they had to leave. The Russians were coming. It was towards the end of the war. And they left in January, ankle-deep in snow, horse and wagon, and go west. Anyone that stopped over the river Oder, after 6 months, they were just shot. There's no questions asked.
What would be some of your earliest memories as a child?
Well, starting off, we had to walk to school. Sometimes some of the people driving past used to pick us up and give us a ride. And I know one stage there was the PMG, we went, used to pick us up, myself and my brother. There were three fellas in the little ute, and then we'd hop in on top of it. Of course, those days, it was allowed. And then later on, then often, when some of the neighbours, they were carting hay with trucks, and if we were walking along the road, Dad'd stop, and we'd hop on the truck and get a ride to Greenock. And I know one stage we had they had picked up hay somewhere. It was a semi, and they stopped to pick us up, and one stood between the truck and the cab, and then the other two of us, cousins and us, we stood on the running board. And then when the truck speeded up, then the mud from between the twin wheels come out and really hit us in the side. My gosh, that started to hurt pretty bad. But fancy when you think, fancy trucks stopping, and even though we're going up a hill, they'd stop and give us a lift. We got a lot of rides. And of course, once we got our push bike, well, then we didn't have to get a ride anymore. But Dad, I don't think he ever took us to school. Doesn't matter how much it rained, we had to dodge between showers and trees. And if it's a heavy shower come, we had sort of coats on, but then you just stand behind the tree until the shower was finished.
So you learnt to read the weather from a young age?
Yes, yeah.
I mean, growing up to live on the land, yes. Was the weather something you'd always be keeping an eye on?
Yes, and if it was showery, you sort of made sure that you got going a bit early to make get between the showers. And one thing what I always remember going to school, Lauke Mill was still functioning that stage, and they had a engine going. And if the engine was going, we knew we were running late, because they always started at 9 o'clock, the engine. And we had to get past that before 9 o'clock to get in time for school.
And you'd mentioned earlier that was, you were about a mile and a half outside of Greenock.
Yes, yes. It was a mile and a half.
You must have been pretty fit.
Yes, well, I think all young children were, even for, at school, we had plenty of exercises to do, and I think the teachers used to keep us pretty fit. The one who I started school with the first day school was Hedley Bachman, and he worked in the Premier's department all his working life. And another one who also went to Greenock School, was a year younger than myself, was Kevin Obst, and he was the organiser of two Royal Tours. He worked in the Road Transport Department.
Still keep in touch with many of your primary school?
The only one I really keep in contact who I went to is Ray Obst. He worked all his life for Lauke Milling Company. He was the manager of Lauke Milling Company.
What are your memories of World War II as a child?
Well, we had to keep our blinds at night. We weren't allowed to have any light, open light shining out through the window. If we drove anywhere, the lights on the truck, it was only a narrow strip about 2 inches wide. The rest of the headlight had to be all covered in black. We only allowed to buy with ration tickets. Petrol, you can only buy ration tickets. Only so much a week. Even little things like chocolates in a shop, you had to order it and wait for a fortnight before you get a chocolate.
Might not feel like it by then.
Yes. Well, there was no sport during the war years. That was all cut out.
Was it a scary time? Did you feel like afraid of what was going to happen, or did you feel safe enough?
It didn't really worry us that much. They did dig air raid trenches at Greenock School. Quite a few from Greenock were involved in the armed services.
Do you remember the day World War II finished?
Yes, I still remember that day. We were in school, and all of a sudden the headmaster come in, got news, the war is over, it's finished with. So I think you can have a half a day's holiday, you can go home. So that was all right. I know in Greenock there were big end of war celebrations, but we didn't go down. Well, when we were young, the parents only more or spoke German. And when my brother Des, my older brother, started school, a fortnight before he started school, they had to teach him English, because you dare not speak German when we went to school. And we both went to school. We went to school in Greenock, had to walk first year and a half, walk 1.5 miles to school, and make sure your boots are clean when you get to school. The old teacher was a bit tough. Second year, then Dad bought a bike, so then we used to take him to us riding a bike. Finished our school in Greenock, then went to Neary High School, and I only went 1 year to high school, because things were a bit different for me those days. Those days, if you wanted to leave, do anything, you had to get your leaving. I'd done my first year and leaving in 1 year, so I got through quick. I was only too pleased to get out.
So what age were you when you left school?
14. Then home, then pick apricots and pick grapes. And when you're only 14 and out in the hot sun, the day is pretty long when you're that young. I know sometimes somebody said something, I'd stood up and just listen, and Dad look up from over a bit further. Get your head down and keep picking grapes. Don't stand up and talk. So he was quite tough. A lot of the pickers, yes, they talk between themselves, but sometimes didn't quite hear, so I just stand up and just listen. But not, you're not supposed to stand up. You can talk, but keep working. Wintertime prune vines, you know, doesn't matter how much rain, you always had to be out in the vineyard. And doesn't matter if you was ankle deep in mud all day, that was all right, that was normal, as far as Dad was concerned. And not too much, no sport. He was not interested in sport. He loved to play football when he was young, and they encouraged to come and play for Greenock, but his dad said, your place is home, otherwise half the week you're home with injuries and you're not working, so you stay home and work, not go and play football. So, but I was no good at any sport, so that was long and the short of it.
Whereabouts was the family home in Greenock?
A mile and a half out of Greenock on the Capunda Road. I don't know whether you ever go out that way. You come to a corner where the Air Museum is.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yep.
The Air Museum, my cousin's got that. My Linkinitsky, he's got that. And just across the road, a red-roofed house. That's where I grew up.
What can you tell me about entertainment on the farm? What would you do to keep yourself amused in between all the jobs that you had to tend to?
Might go trap a few rabbits or a bit of spotlighting. And no, apart from that, when I was a bit older, and I did play a bit of table tennis, and I quite enjoyed that. Not that I was much good at it, but it was still good fun. Yeah. I think I might have watched one or two football matches towards the end, but apart from that, I never go to any sport.
How many were in your family? How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I got, there were six of us in the family, five boys and one girl. I was the second oldest, and my sister Elizabeth was the next one. Then there was Gilbert, and then Roy and Keith, the youngest ones, they were twins.
A big cluster of brothers.
Yes, yes.
How did you all get on?
Oh, near enough, not too bad. Des was, I suppose, a bit different because he went into teaching, and he was a teacher, and so his views were a little bit different than me, but well, he was a teacher, that was his job. I was a farmer. Gilbert was a solicitor. Elizabeth, she went nursing and then she went interstate. Roy, he went to work in New Guinea and then he became a pilot, and he worked for Air New Guinea for a good many years until he retired. And now he's come back and lives in Thornlands in Queensland. Mm-hmm. And Keith, the other one, he also bought part of Dad's farm, and he passed away, must be about 4 years ago. I suppose we got reasonably on well together. Keith and myself sometimes didn't see eye to eye. Well, it does happen when brothers.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, but otherwise, we worked together for fairly well for quite a number of years, but then could realise we were aiming for different paths, so it was better if we both went our own way. Each one can do as they like. Mm-hmm. And then, I had a son then out of school, and then Keith was getting family out of school, so it was better than each one go their own way.
Has all of your adult life been based on the farm?
Yes.
Did you ever venture away from the farm? Or
it's... No, my uncle asked me about whether I'd be interested in buying a farm down at Cook's Plains, Ben Kleinig, and he was down Cook's Plains, and he liked to get a couple more people come down there, but I would have quite liked it, but if I would have wanted to go away from home, I would have needed Dad to help me buy the farm. Well, then Dad didn't have help at home, so I more or less resigned the fact I'm staying home. And then later years, then the neighbours, a couple of neighbours' properties were for sale. So I bought them, and one of them ended up, I married a Nitschke girl, and that was the old Nitschke home where the Nitschke started off in Greenock. And that's where the old grandfather that started off Nitschke Chaff, that's where he started off. And the first chaff was cut on a paddock where I built a new house, where in that area, that was where the first Nitschke chaff were cut. And after that, then they took they bought their property out Nain and built a chaff mill in Nain. And now that's been going for over 100 years. And now my cousin he's sold it now to his son again. So my father-in-law had the chaff mill, and because my nephew worked for him from the time he left school, and father-in-law had no boys, so he sold it to Mal Konecki, who worked for him ever since he left school. So he bought that, then he bought like father-in-law's place, and then he bought another neighbouring property out Nain, Albert Schwartz, another 300 acres he bought that. And now they cart chaff virtually all over Australia.
That's quite a big setup, isn't it?
Yes, he's from a very little humble chaff mill to, as modern as you can get now, yes.
You mentioned there that you married a Nitschke. What was your wife's name?
Margaret Nitschke.
Margaret Nitschke.
Yes.
What year did you get married?
1961, 11th of February 1961.
And can you tell me about the first time you met?
Oh, Margaret, we sort of grew up together. We were, right from young on, we went to the same church. And then Margaret picked grapes for Dad, and eventually from then it sort of ended up getting married to her. Margaret's got three sisters. There's Peggy Lindner, there's Carl Lindner, you might have heard of Carl Lindner. Well, Peggy, that's one of Margaret's sisters. And then there's Diane, she married a Ulrich. And then Barbara married a Helbig. She lives up in the Wakery.
How many children did you have? Tell me a little bit about your family.
Three children. Joe had five children, and Sandy had three, and I had two. And I got two great-grandsons.
And do you see them often?
Yeah, Joe Fechner lived in Angaston, and Joe, she works in the Tanunda Medical Centre. And her husband, they got vineyard and cattle. And Sandy, she lives in Wakery. They got an electrical business, Hanson Electrical in Wakery. David, he's home on the farm.
Can you tell me a little bit about the different varieties of grape that you used to have? And then maybe talk me through the pruning process?
Well, the ones we had mainly was Shiraz, Grenache, Matara, had some sherry, and had a few Gordos, but mainly Shiraz, Grenache, Matara, and Doradellas. That was the main varieties we always had. And then later on, then Pedro came in. Pedro was a new variety, and for a while we were getting nearly as much for the Pedro as we got for Shiraz. Only thing, Pedro we could pick quicker and bear three times as much. But that didn't last long. After a few years, then the Pedro price dropped pretty well and wasn't so much sought after. And even in the one stage, Shiraz, we couldn't sell Shiraz because I don't know why they didn't want them. And there were hundreds of acres of Shiraz pulled out, old vines, really old vines. And anyhow, I know my brother, he had a block, and he asked Penfolds quite a few times, how about getting a bit of a better price for them? No, we can't pay any more. And eventually he pulled them out. The day after he pulled them out, they came in, yeah, we're prepared to offer you more now. Yeah, not much good then. Well, I pulled a lot of Shiraz out too and planted, but then a few years when the Shiraz started coming in, then a couple blocks of old Matara I pulled out and I planted Shiraz again because I thought, well, it takes 3 years for them really to bear and by that time things will change. I was lucky it did change and then I got a good price for Shiraz.
So the prices every year fluctuated quite a lot?
Yes, yes. Some years they always creep up a bit every year, and now this year they're creeping down a fair bit, and there's quite a few growers. They can't sell all their grapes because, well, since we've lost the Chinese market, that has had a big influence on the grape industry. And, well, I've seen it too up the river. There's acres and acres Shiraz they've cut off.
Really?
And they're waiting for them to... they're going to graft something else on. Hopefully that'll sell then. I've seen quite a few times good years with grapes and then some pretty poor years. But it's nearly like this. If you only want always the top, it doesn't often come that way. You got to take good with the bad. And some years, well, with the prices were pretty low, you wouldn't make much, but you could still make a living. But if you wanted to put some money away, there was nothing in it.
Mm.
So, but that's the same even with wool. The wool was really at rock bottom and cheap, prices were poor. And I know a few times some of the owners, they sent sheep to like the abattoirs, Adelaide, and when they got the docket back, they got an account with them to help pay for the transport. The cost, what they got for the sheep, didn't even cover the transport.
So it wasn't worth it.
Yeah.
Mm.
Now those same sheep, some would get up to over $100. And yet a few years ago, you're lucky to get five.
Mm. So did you have sheep at any stage?
Yes, yeah, we had sheep.
You did?
Not many, but... And that was the same with wool. Some years the wool was sort of always went up a bit, quite a good price, then it dropped a bit. And one year it dropped 10 cents. And I thought, well, that's 10 cents a kilo. And I thought, well, no, I won't sell, I'll wait 4 weeks, it'll go up again like normally it used to. But then 4 weeks' time, then it dropped 40 cents. Well, then I had to sell. So if I would have took the 10 cent, I'd have been far better off.
Mm.
But you always know afterwards. Hay too, that was always reasonably priced. It wasn't over high, but it was a good sideline. And one was always sure one could always sell it. But the most I ever sold was, I think, 100 ton. That was the most I sold, but a lot of times it was only between 30 and 40.
100 ton of hay?
Yes.
So how much property did you have? How much acreage did you have?
I had 200 when I was the owner, but now David, he's got, he'd have about 350 acres now, and then he rents a bit of land, extra land yet for sheep running.
Did you know Ross and Roma Koch?
Yes, yes.
From Roland Flat?
Yes.
They lived on the main road going up the hill, yeah, with the big right. water
yes,
tank?
Yes, yeah. He was the one that really set the irrigation going pretty well. He was one of the instigators of it around that way, but then others soon followed.
Right.
He made a big dam down from his house in the gully, and mm-hmm. across the road from where he lives.
And then they used that to irrigate all that block. Yeah. I believe you are a master pruner. Can you tell me a little bit about pruning?
I pruned the vines how I thought was the best for them. Rod and spur, most cases gave them three rods. Some only used to give them two rods, but three rods and then three or four spurs. I used to find it quite interesting pruning because you'd be training the vine, and the vine, if it's getting about, you see this one spur here, well, that'll be handy. So you leave that spur there, so a couple of buds come out, so their neck can be cut off next year and take that one along. I found pruning pretty interesting as far as shaving vines, your young vines, getting them up to where, what do you like. When I was young, all the vines were only about that high. Now most of them are, you know, that high before I get onto trellis.
Mm-hmm. How much time would you spend pruning?
Well, most cases we used to start off in May and we'd prune till end of September. Well, we'd hardly ever have a day off, never. I think only one or two days I had off that when it was very wet. I know one year we had very heavy crop of grapes and of course started a bit late, and it was 22nd of May before we finished picking, and then Dad said, I think next week you can go and start pruning. And so then it was pruning until, except took a bit of time off to do a bit of cropping for Dad that time.
There was no break, pretty well straight into it.
Yeah, early we used to put them in, you know, from four vines, put them in a heap, then we used to burn them. And then later we got a slasher, just let the rods lie in the middle of the row and go up with a slasher. Kept a bit of the wood in the vineyard, helped to keep the soil open.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When we used to burn them, that was quite a long job, always burning horse and a burner. A lot of the time the horse would be pretty well trained, used to walk up the middle of the row and occasionally get a bit to one side. And when you hear something, well, just one arm broken off, so get the fire wagon back in the middle of the row again. So the machine started coming in. We had a cutter bar on the side of the tractor. Well, there's a few different machines, and then you just drive up the row. But after a couple of years, the winery said, no, that's not good enough. You can use it, but then you've got to go through afterwards and clean out all the extra wood, because otherwise the whole vine nearly gets like a briar bush. It just shoots all, and then too many smaller berries, and they don't like that in the wine either. Last couple of years, we haven't worried to hedge anymore, but I've done, for quite a few years, I've done quite a lot of hedging. It did save a lot of time. But another thing is, we found out too, we were getting a lot more dieback in the vineyard, because then hedging, we had permanent arm. You didn't put a new rod every year, and then that arm dry off, and then the vine dry back too. So that meant after some years, if you left it go too long, then you had to replant the block of vines and start off from scratch again.
So is that controlling where moisture content is?
Yeah, I think what happened when permanent arm, you wrap this rod along the wire, but then as after a few years, the rod sort of expands and then cuts off the moisture. And of course, that's like if you stop the circulation in your finger, gradually you'll drop off.
Mm.
And that's very much like that in the vines. But in a lot of cases too, in the latter part of my life, came across, had permanent arm in different blocks, but then a water shoot would come out from the ground, and then you train that water shoot up and cut the dead arm off. Because if you leave the dead arm there, gradually it gets to the point where it rots off, and then if you go through with machine harvesting, that drops into the grapes, and then you're in trouble when you get to the winery. So it blocks mm-hmm. the crusher up again.
What's a water shoot?
Water shoot is another shoot that comes out from the base of the vine, and sometimes they grow pretty good. And the other thing, I suppose, which was later in life, was machine harvesting. David had bought a machine, and we started machining. But the wineries don't want it all machine harvested. Some don't mind. Some, they machine everything. But then there's always some vines got second crop. It's like another little bunch comes out later than what, And they're not quite ripe when you harvest. And with a machine, well, they all get knocked in. Whereas you hand pick, you tell the pickers don't take them off. They say it makes better quality.
Come back for them a bit later.
Yes, yeah.
Do the harvesters damage the vines?
Well, it depends a lot. Sometimes you got to have the beaters going pretty hard and fast, and some years the grapes might be just that little bit withery and they're hard to shake off. But a lot of times different ones used to put the irrigation on the night before for say 2 hours, and that give you just enough to freshen the grapes up. Wouldn't interfere with the quality, but freshen them up, and that'd knock off a lot easier. And then there's some varieties, the canes will knock off a lot more than other varieties. Some varieties are more brittle.
So there's a lot to learn.
Then it's nearly like when you go with a harvester into a crop of wheat. Well, the one crop will thrash quite good, but then when you go to the next crop, you've got to sort of look at the sample and then set the machine accordingly. Yeah.
Before the introduction of machine harvesting, when it was picking season, how many people would be working your crew?
Well, the most I ever had, I think, was 14, but a lot of times I only used to have 8 or 10 pickers. And they're pretty regular. We'd get through with them all right.
Would they be mainly locals, or would there be backpackers?
Yes, backpackers, tourists, quite a few that lived in the area. I don't know, you know what fat hen is? It's a weed.
A weed, sorry, yeah. Yes, yeah.
This one lady, she was picking the leaves off and eating them. I said, oh, because, you know, the cows don't even like eating them. Even the sheep don't like it much. There's no good in it. Or, she said, you look at the vitamins that are in there. That's healthy for you. And she'd be every day, lunchtime, pick a few leaves off and eat them. Well, she survived.
She survived them.
Didn't do any harm.
So you've just brought back a memory for me. Working in the vineyard, there was a couple of ladies who'd been picking grapes for, I think, probably 60 years.
Yes.
In working for Ross. And they were just chatting away, but they were so quick.
Yeah.
And they were just chatting away amongst themselves. Yeah. Buckets were full in no time.
Yeah. And yet when you look at them, they weren't hurrying. And yet the grapes come off. Yeah. Yeah, I had one picker there. She didn't only me, but she picked for me for, I suppose, 20 years. And never complain about backache or nothing. And always go flat out. And but when I left school, that was just after the war years. Pickers were very scarce, and there was a couple elderly ladies from Grinnell picked for Dad, and there was one lady, I'll finish up, she was over 70, by being 75, and there were no vines, and all day she'd be standing up and leaning over the vines and picking like anything. And don't your backache? No, I wouldn't know what backache is. Never had backache in my life. And finish up, the family said she's not supposed to go out picking. Oh, she said, I'm really so disappointed. I never get out much from home. And when I get out the vineyard, all the different chatter you hear, a lot of news, and a bit of the gossip. And she said she really used to enjoy it.
Mm.
And
it's really social.
Yeah, and never ever complain.
How many years have you been growing grapes?
Oh, and I actually gave up. I think I transferred my property about 10 years ago. Now, from 1949 was the first year out till, well, say 2000.
59 years.
That's how long I was involved with grapes, farming, sheep.
It's a lot of grapes.
Yes, yeah. Saw a lot of sunrises and sunsets, a lot of dust storms, a lot of hail showers. Oh, well, it was an interesting life. A few times floods in the creeks. Couldn't get through the creek, water's too high. And then when I was young, Dad had horses. He had horses till I was about the last horse we had, I would have been about 30 years old. Then it was all tractor work.
when the machinery was introduced, did you realise how much of an impact that was going to have on what you could get done within a day, for example? Or...
Well, different things was, in the horse days, there used to be a dodger. You'd, with one horse, plough the grass and from under the vine out. And we thought, well, you can never do without that. Then later, like with the tractors and with three-point linkage tractor, and then they started bringing in a dodger, made a dodger, and Trevor Shear at Tanunda, he made one of the better dodgers that was made, fit on a tractor. And then sometimes you could weed and like disc in the vineyard at the same time. And with the dodger, well, with the foot, you press a button and it'd go out, hydraulic out, and we get the vine, take the pressure off, then come back, go around the vine, then in again. And if you was sleeping, got to sleep, well, when the vine lifted out, you knew you hit it. Well, some years we had good crops with the grapes. Some years we had too much rain in September, and then they didn't set. Some years hail and frost. I know I planted one block of vines. The first year, well, I would have had a good crop, and the hail wiped it out on the, I think it was the 6th of October, and there was no crop that year, so I had to wait until the next year. Then a couple of years later, then crops were good, but then I couldn't sell them all again, so I ended up taking some up to Clare.
Were you ever left at seasons with lots of crop still on the vine?
I think that the thing was, at that stage, there was a lot of young vines came in and they hadn't really gone into the export market that much yet. And Australia was growing more grapes than what they could sell. And then it was a few years later than that, then they decided that the government would pay us so much if we pulled the vines out. But then we weren't allowed to replant that block for 10 years. I was going to pull out one block that I wasn't very good, but then I thought, no, if I can't replant in 10 years, a lot of things might happen in 2 or 3 years' time. So I didn't go on with that scheme.
Did a lot of other people rip up lot of vines?
Yes, quite a lot.
When was that, Milton?
That was in the 80, around the 80s, I think it was. It was quite a few years ago.
Can I ask you maybe to talk a little bit about farming techniques with me?
Well, when I first left school, whatever we wanted to sow the following year, we always used to fallow in July, August, around that time, and then work it during the summer, because those days there was no sprays. And then through working a lot and get a lot of summer rain and early winter rain, got a lot of erosion. And then the Department of Ag came in, that would have been in the 60s, they came in with doing contour banking, so that instead of working the farmland sort of, or straight up and down, now then you work it on a contour, the water drains around, and there's only narrow strips, might be only 5-6 chains between the contour banks. Other times it might be 20, just depends on the layout of the ground. Mm. If it was fairly steep, well then you had more contour banks. And I'd done a lot of that home there, and a lot of our country that had been badly eroded, we sort of changed that around to more productive country. No, not those big gutters going down. Sometimes I remember sowing and get a lot of rain, and then you get these gutters going down. Then when you want to cut hay, you're going across, well, then the binder got to go over a gutter like that. Then we, any time, had to put sheaves in for the binder to get across. And first, a lot of them said, there'd be too many corners. But then when you had all these deep gutters, well, eventually you couldn't go through anymore. You had to go around them, so that was corners too.
Mm.
But the soil was always gone down the creek, gone. So it was with the contour banks. And then even like, then a lot started planting contours in the vineyard, so that a lot of times all the old vineyards were sort of planted straight up the hill. And then in the summertime, all those days had to work it quite a bit to kill the weeds, and then you get rain and the water on top of the hill could, and either it was in the creek or out on the road, he has a good soil.
Mm-hmm.
And eventually then the vines, they deteriorated then.
Can you explain to me the idea of how contour banking works?
Well, they work them out on a certain level. First, the contour banks were made two level. They were right when they were first done because it was clear, but after years, then grass grows in. Of course, then the water can't run away, then banks up and go over the bank, so then creates gutters again. So then the Department of Ag, they worked out every 20 steps it had to fall so much. So every 20 steps had to fall perhaps that much. That way the water would run right around, either into a dam or to the edge of the paddock. And then we had water drains that put in a lot of seed and clover and grassed it up, so that when the water ran down the waterways, it didn't wash them out. And after the first year, usually there was enough grass in the waterway to stop them from washing out.
Mm-hmm.
But in not only in our area, in a lot of farming areas, there were thousands of acres were contour banked. And like my neighbour, Heine Wendt, he was one of the first contractors to do contour banking with the, he had crawler tractors,
mm-hmm.
and then an angle blade. Yeah, that really put a lot of country that had been eroded badly into good productive country again. Carton Hay, I don't know, you know the arch in Tanunda by Schrabels. The one load of hay when Garrett's had the chaff mill. They used to buy a lot of hay for chaffing. And there was one on the stack there said, if we only had a little comma truck, if you could bring a load of 5 tonne in. We used to have quite a lot of loads of 415, 416, 417. And he said, if you bring a one load of 5 tonne in, I'll shout you a butcher of beer. And anyhow, the lad working with me, the last load, he said, we're going to get this butcher of beer. So we loaded up this load of hay. Well, if the police would have caught us, we would have been in trouble, but it was far too high. When we got to the arch, we couldn't get through. So anyhow, then you went on the wrong side of the road, then you had a bit more room. So we went on the wrong side of the road, and the lad, he crawled on top of the load, and he pressed the sheave down while it slowly slid, the front slid through. When we was far enough, he yelled out to me to stop, then he crawled down, and then we went around to Garrett. And Garrett was a JP, and he was the owner of the chaff mill, and he saw us come, and then when we got down there, and did we get a dressing down. For us young lads, the biggest dressing down from a stranger we ever got. I smiled. And we got our butcher of beer. Another time we had a load of hay. It had quite a bit of ryegrass in it. That's very slippery. And it slipped out. And anyhow, we only just got it to the height of the hurdles. And they said, we can't go any further. We'll lose the load. So the load slipped out right along the driver's side. The hay had gone that far. I just could put my knees against the sheaves of hay when they should have been up about there. So that's how far. And on the way between Newry and Tanunda, we had the whole road to ourselves. When the car saw us coming, they all pulled right off the road because they were frightened we'd tip on them. But then luckily the police didn't see us.
And you got there? You got
there? Yeah, got there, that's right. But at another stage, through a neighbour, Dirk Meerton, said he was an officer in charge of Newry years ago. He said to the neighbour, if you see those boys carting hay, just tell them they better keep their hay in a bit narrower. They're going too wide. If I'm on the road and I'm in with my mate, well, I'm afraid we'd have to book them. He said, because if I'm by myself, well, I'll give them a warning. But if my mate's with, well, then we'd have to book them. Old Dirk, he was quite a lad. He was good, he was solid, and yet he was good to get on with. different little things like interesting life, even like spotlighting sometimes. You have a few close shaves, then you got to watch where you shoot at night because the bullets don't always stop here. Carl Lindner had that experience one night. They used to come out home catching hares. There was Carl and Schwartz. And then one night after they left us, they were finished with us, they were down Gummersall. And they shot at a fox. And anyhow, they missed the fox. Well, but they had high-powered rifles. And all they heard was the bullet went, wow! Well, they thought, where is that going to? Anyhow, 10 minutes later, there were lights coming up the road. And they, well, now, who's got the gun license? Well, I think Carl, he done the shooting. Well, whoever had done the shooting didn't have a license. And the other one, he had a license. So I said, well, if we get in trouble, I'll take the blame. So anyhow, they got out of a warning. The bullet went down 3 miles and landed in a come through a window of a toilet where a fella was sitting in. I think he forgot what he was doing.
You're a member of the Narn Lutheran Church?
Yes. I've been a member all my life. Been the longest member there, but I'm not quite the oldest, but I've been a member the longest in the church. There's one older, Lorna Zilm, she's 99, she's still a member. And Ray Oakes, well, he's a bit older than me, so I might be the second oldest, but apart from that, I've been there the longest. And Narn Lutheran Church, that's the oldest Lutheran church being used in Australia. My wife's great-great-grandfather, he built it.
Being a member of the Narn Lutheran Church all of your life, what have been some of the biggest changes, perhaps, within the church and the community, would you say?
Well, when I was young, the men would always sit one side, the women always the other side. But then I suppose when I was, after I got married, then there was a few men were starting to sit with their wives. And of course, then those younger ones. So now it was whoever it is, men and women, they sit together in the church. But now we've got a pastor again now in our parish, a pastor, Emingi. He come from Victoria. And actually, this home is built on Mingi ground. Lance Mingi used to own it.
Can you tell me a little bit about your involvement with the Greenock CFS?
Yes, I was involved for a good many years, and at the one stage there, a petrol tanker run into come into Greenock. That was before the bypass, and come around the corner where the shop is. I don't know what happened, but run off the road into a house, and it turned over, tipped over, blew up in flames. And there was, the driver was lost his life, and two people in the house lost their life. And there was a little boy in the house, and the fire chief knew what the house was like, so he got through a back window, saved his life. There was quite a few incidents where fire, we were also involved with some rescue work years ago when the floods were, when it was all flooded down Virginia. People used to get to places and they couldn't get back home, and they wanted somebody, so how to drive and pick them up. Quite a few traffic incidents over the years.
So how many years were you involved?
I've been in there about 30 years.
Did you train every week?
Once every Tuesday night. Ray Oakes here, he was commissioned a new CFS chief. The night before that petrol tank accident. So that was his first session next morning, 6 o'clock in the morning. Never really anything, well, they were serious, but not too serious. Not as bad as the last major fire we had.
Pinery?
Yes,
Oh, that was bad, wasn't it?
Yes. Well, when that one, I was I had retired by that time. I remember I was still home that time, and I had three phone calls that I was supposed to get out the house because the fire was coming from Freeling towards Greenock. And I said, no, I said, I'll stay there. There's a vineyard just below my house, and the smoke was that thick at one stage. It was that black, I couldn't see you from here to you. I couldn't see you. That's how dark it was from the smoke, because there was a lot of baled hay being burnt, and that sort of green, well, was not quite dry either, and that when that burns, that sends off a lot of smoke.
Mm.
So it got within the edge of Greenock, but then they managed to stop it there, and the other side went to Kapunda, and they stopped it on the Turo Kapunda Road.
Also a member of the Greenock Institute Committee.
Yes, yeah, for quite a few years, either 10 years or so. I suppose with the CFS, a lot of them that were in the CFS were also involved with the Institute. So, one gets involved one or the other a bit. Same as the school committee too, with children going to school there. So we get involved in there. My dad finished off in primary school. I did. My son and my grandchildren finished in Greenock Primary School.
From what you've witnessed and experienced over the years, how do you think the Barossa Valley has changed over the years?
Well, traffic has changed a few. The roads have changed. Greenock had a bypass, and Kapunda got a bypass. The Sturt Highway, the traffic in Greenock, all the traffic had to come through Greenock to Adelaide, whether it was coming from Kapunda or near Eucta, and that created every now and again quite a problem in Greenock. And with the bypasses, first it was thought Greenock won't survive, but Greenock actually grew after the bypasses came. And the hotel changed places, a couple of the shops closed, the baker stopped baking, butcher stopped being a butcher shop in Greenock.
So a lot of the smaller businesses kind of have disappeared now.
And then after the war, then Greenock started playing football again. They had had a good team for many years, won grand finals, and then some of the boys started playing up a bit, and of course some of the young ones weren't too happy about it. So then they went playing for other teams. So then the Greenock team come to an end.
What? How long ago was the Greenock Football Club?
That would have been finished about 1980, somewhere like that. I'm not too sure about that. But since then they've got into cricket again, and Greenock's got, I think, three or four cricket teams.
I have to say, it's a nice drive when you go out to Greenock. It's a lovely drive through the town.
Yes, yeah.
If you had just a few words to pass on to the youth of today, any advice for the youth of today, what would you say to them?
Well, number one, respect your teachers or respect your parents, and respect the police. And respect is one of the biggest problems, I think, today is. That's why we see so much trouble. The other thing is, like me, like David taking over, there's a lot of things I see which, I would perhaps do different. But then I got to realise I've had my day. So you've got to leave go, and you've got to let the next generation work out for themselves what they really want to do and how to work it out. You can talk about it, but don't push and tell them what to do. That's the way I feel.
So looking back at all of your years on the land, it was a good experience, good family way of life.
Oh, yes.
Very positive.
Yeah, I was happy there. You could always try a few different things out on the farm, experiment and try things. Sometimes it worked out, sometimes it didn't. But on the other hand, again, I think I had a good life. And even now living in here, there's a lot of times I wouldn't mind if I could be back home. But if you get to a stage where you can't do anything and you start collapsing, well, then you've got to think about what you're going to do. So that's when I came in here.
Milton Materne, thank you so much for agreeing to chat with me and be a part of the Barossa Village Oral History Project. It's been an absolute privilege to meet you and to hear and share some of the stories you've shared with me today. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for even asking me, listening to me.
It's my absolute pleasure.
You have been listening to a podcast from the Barossa Village Oral History Project. Further podcasts can be found and downloaded at thewaywewere.podbean.com.